Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John. This week we'll be talking about Fidelity's dive into custodial services for Bitcoin and Ethereum. The Ethereum Foundation has just given out their fourth wave of grants to support development on that blockchain platform. And Accenture has come out with a pair of reports on what's going on in FinTech, how it's taking a bite out of the incumbent banks, and what they should do about it. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. I'm not back in the black, but I do have some Ethereum now.
Who are you?
Yeah. I'm there's a little tiny pool for high risk kind of things. All right, so let's get started. With me this week is Steve.
Hi, everyone.
All right. Thanks for joining. And Monica will be joining us back again next week. All right. Our first article is on Fidelity, not the name you would typically think of being cutting edge and developing new things in fintech, but they are huge. They actually manage over $7 trillion in assets. They're the fourth largest asset manager in the world.
Who's the first?
I think it's BlackRock.
BlackRock. Yes. You pass the test. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. So the CEO, Abigail Johnson, has been very crypto-friendly, and she has an interest in innovation and blockchain and what the potential for that is. So they've been testing here and there on mining and some initial transactions, but now they're going full in, and they're going to provide custodial services. Now, that doesn't mean that you, Steve, can start trading or anything on Fidelity. This is purely for their institutional clients and very high net worth type of people, money managers. So they can trade in either Bitcoin or Ether. And this is one of the another one of those steps that we see kind of slowly crawling towards getting widespread mainstream acceptance for Bitcoin and Ether. But at the same time, we see that people are calling for the crash of Bitcoin. They say that the value is zero. But so it's kind of like I see kind of it's all one way or all the other way.
I think this is interesting because essentially what these people are doing, what the hedge funds are doing here and the traders is that they're looking for volatility in the market and doing this kind of stuff when Bitcoin is so volatile nowadays. Even if you don't see it as a long-term solution, could really make this a good play for them from a financial perspective.
Yeah. And it's just the obstacles that a lot of people have to overcome to get acceptance for trading these crypto assets.
Right.
There's definitely the risk. There's regulatory uncertainty, and there's certainly the stability issue. But there seems to be some drive to getting, even though we've seen almost all of the crypto assets have so much less volume in trading than they did before. It kind of worries me a little bit, but I almost feel like with all these like a Gemini and Fidelity and Goldman getting into supporting institutional assets that you know maybe it'll just happen all in a wave, and we'll see another drive up in volume and consequently the price of at least the leading crypto assets.
So a general question on this, does Fidelity help you with their services to trade in Bitcoin or Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
No, just Bitcoin and Ether. And, you know, they're the most developed. Ether is very focused on developing a software platform. They have a wide acceptance all over the world as far as the software side. There's a lot of work going into that, which we'll get into in our next article, actually. So some good news for Fidelity is that they got their first customer just a day after announcing this service. And it's called Fidelity Digital Asset Services, LLC. And so this first customer, which I guess they had that in line already when they're building this up, but it's a familiar face in crypto, Mike Novogratz. He's a billionaire that's developed or that's created this company called Galaxy Digital that's meant to be a merchant bank for crypto assets. So they want to provide a full-service merchant banking business, and they're going to use Fidelity's new service for their blockchain and Ether. And he's put in $302 million into Galaxy Digital.
That's a nice chunk of change.
Yeah, so you see so much, a lot of money into developing these services for trading Getting institutions and like I said, mainstream acceptance, that it's hard to imagine that the volumes won't bounce back up.
That's pretty interesting. So I wonder, are there any Bitcoin-only hedge funds?
Yeah, good question. There's actually, I just saw recently, there's over 120 hedge funds that are involved in crypto assets with about $2.3 billion, it was estimated, that's invested. And that's far less than what individual investors and people around the world have put in. But it's a step towards, getting this mainstream acceptance and investing on behalf of others, so widening the footprint of investors in cryptocurrencies.
So it's a small, not insignificant, but a small but growing market.
Yeah, right. And this Galaxy Digital aims to make things easier for people to and institutions to invest in Bitcoin and in Ether, and that's part of their merchant banking services. For now, they're going to use Fidelity for their custodial services and for their trading back end. And actually, Fidelity, before having their own service, they used Coinbase as their backend, as their custodial and trading services.
That's actually my next question is, you know, now that you're getting more established incumbent institutions getting into the space, how will this affect the Coinbases of the world?
Yeah, right. Definitely a competitor. Coinbase is building up really fast. So you can see on their job listings, on their website, and the funding that they continue to get, that they're really building up to go against the big guys, and they have the money to do it.
Right. But even with their growth they're having now in terms of the job openings and the markets they're getting into, it'll be really hard for them to compete with the fifth largest asset management manager in the world.
Yeah, the fourth largest, and with over $7 trillion, under management. I mean, they definitely have the firepower and they're using it. It's something that, you know, a smart move that they should do.
So any indication as to whether the largest asset manager, BlackRock, is getting into Bitcoin?
Well, BlackRock has announced that they're testing, and the infamous proof of concepts has been across all of the large financial institutions. Yeah. We don't have a lot of clarity into how close they are and what their plans are as far as releasing. So Fidelity might have some close competition since they've been testing for a while now. So you would think that they're getting close and they could release imminently. So the thing that's making these cryptocurrencies so valuable is all the potential, and we emphasize potential, because what it can do is so wide. I mean, I think we're just seeing just a tiny sliver of what it can become. I just read somewhere recently where Thomas Edison, when they asked him, what's this phonograph going to be good for? He mentioned things like you can record the last words of someone before they die. You can record like education classes, spelling lessons on there, and a few other things. But one thing he never mentioned was music. And of course, that's the main use of phonographs. And that made me really think about blockchain. We may not even be thinking about the most obvious thing that it's going to be used for.
So we basically may have the most rudimentary use cases now, and the actual thing that will make this go mega may come down the line 5, 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah. And there's a lot of effort, a lot of software effort, as I mentioned, going into that. And one of the things that's helping that along is the Ethereum Foundation. They just announced their fourth wave of grants they're giving out to people that are solving problems on the blockchain, making tools, making useful things out there. So the Ethereum Foundation gave out $2.86 million to 20 different software projects. And on the Ethereum Foundation website, if you want to get in on Wave 5, for example, they specify certain things that they want solved. Scalability is a big thing, and some other tools that they need to further develop the Ethereum blockchain. So they invite people that are building software solutions or have ideas for that to get these grants, and they'll help you get there.
So they basically work as a grant maker. They can help smaller players scale up and build more interesting use cases for their platform.
Yeah, exactly. So it makes Ethereum stronger, and maybe you get a business case out of it. The Ethereum Foundation states that these are not intended to be a source of profit or the main source of funding for these projects. It's mainly kind of jump-starting existing efforts out there. So these aren't small grants. The top two recipients got $500,000 each to further develop their programs.
That could help you scale up.
Yeah, I'll take that if I was able to code at all. I mean, this goes to show how much work has to go into making these things useful. I mean, this is a huge undertaking. I mean, Ethereum kind of defines itself as a future computer of the world. So naturally, it takes a huge amount of effort. So this is just one small part of that.
I have to say, it seems like a really smart play for them to bring on new players onto their platform and to speed up their adoption of their Ethereum protocol.
Yeah, sure. It's very exciting and something people want to get into. Now, one issue that just came up recently with the Ethereum blockchain is the Constantinople upgrade. Now, this was supposed to be a software update to the Ethereum blockchain.
Can you just call it Istanbul?
Istanbul, yeah, that's right. So these are meant to provide five major improvements to increase network efficiency, and it also would have reduced the amount of ethers that were created with each transaction block. So unfortunately, there were some software bugs in this new release, so it's been put off and canceled as of the late October, which we're in. And it was just announced they had a phone call among the major players, and they're going to put that off until early 2019. Mm. These things are meant to address these issues around usability and scalability, getting things to process a little bit quicker and reducing these huge delays in transaction times. So Ethereum is still very popular with developers. The ETH San Francisco hackathon just occurred recently, and that attracted over 1,000 developers from around the world. So a few things going on with Ethereum, and my money is on that. And full disclosure, I am an investor in Ethereum for the long haul.
You would take Ethereum over Bitcoin?
I have. I've never invested in Bitcoin or bought Bitcoin.
So you own no Bitcoin. So
I own no Bitcoin.
Solid financial advice from John right here.
I have owned Ripple, and I like that long-term prospect of they're developing a platform, they're building useful things, and Ethereum was designed to be software, to be this world computer software platform from the very beginning, which is why I felt that was a good bet in a long-term future. But obviously, a lot of hiccups, a lot of ups and downs on the road. But all this development work really shows that, at least to me, that it does have a long-term future.
Really good stuff there on Ethereum and the blockchain. But, John, we talk a lot about sort of the effect that fintech is having on the banking industry. And there are two reports that came out of Accenture, the consulting firm, earlier this month that have two different sides of the coin there in terms of the effect of the fintech industry on traditional / incumbent banks. So what they did is that they analyzed approximately 20,000 banking and payment institutions across 7 markets to see the level of change and disruption in the global banking industry. And there are two very telling headlines here.
Well, there are certain banks that I'd like to be disrupted, for sure.
There are, yeah. So there are two headlines, one from Reuters, which is, fintech is making inroads, but U.S. bank revenues little changed. And the other is, based, by the way, on the same report, global fintech warning to traditional banks. The threat is, quote, real and growing. So two very different takes on the same report.
Yeah, I like the way they get into why the incumbent banks don't perceive the threat. Of course, you think of the frog and in the boiling water as it starts to kill you, but the thing that they identified were that the existing banks didn't see new innovations as being new, that just dressing up old products in kind of like a fancy interface on a mobile
platform, lipstick on a pig,
that they don't see significant revenues from these companies, so they're not worried about them.
It's also the AUM. We talked about Fidelity a few minutes ago. And the AUM of Fidelity completely dwarfs anything we see in the new asset management space.
Yeah, right.
Wealthfront and Betterment, and even the stuff in China, is minuscule compared to what you see within BlackRock and Fidelity and Schwab and any other players.
Meanwhile, the flames are getting, the water's just starting to get warm.
A little warmer, but it's nice and so warm. That's it's pleasant.
Yeah, right, right. So the third thing they saw, exactly what you're saying, is they look at these fintechs and they're not making money. They're not profitable. They see them as kind of playthings or lifestyle, maybe companies for millionaires and not as real threats. But they point out that the threat is real.
It is real. And it's actually interesting how you can really see from this report the effect of regulation. So they point out that in the UK, 63% of the newcomers have taken 14% of the total revenues from some traditional banking players.
Yeah, the UK, I think they had like the most aggressive kind of changes going on in their market.
They did. I think that a lot of that is driven by the fact that they enacted this PSD2 regulation, I believe sometime late last year, that made it a lot easier for you to port over your accounts from one bank to another.
And the open banking initiative thing.
The open banking thing, right, which made it easy for you to transfer banks and sort of try out new players. Although I wonder whether the people who have actually changed from, say, Lloyds or HSBC are going to Revolut or N26 as their primary account or whether they're just kind of trying it out. So that's one issue there is that, again, that you know they've captured 14% of all banking revenue, whereas in the U.S., where we don't have a PSD2 equivalent, fintech upstarts have only captured 3.5% of total revenue.
Of total revenue. Okay, so they are still probably losing money and not jumping in. And we're also much more consolidated here. You know, one thing the report points out is that 50% of new current accounts opened in the U.S. are captured by only three large banks.
Which banks are those?
So very, very consolidated. They didn't. They didn't mention the composition on that.
I'm guessing Chase, B of A, and Wells Fargo or something.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, everyone else.
One thing that's interesting, though, is that a lot of this change, both in the UK and the US, either whether it's 14% or 3.5%, has taken place in the wake of the financial recession in 08. But I wonder once we see the markets now sort of taking a downturn recently, and a downturn in the economy may lead to either a reduction in fintech or neobank adoption or an increase.
Or maybe failures from fintechs.
Or failures, yeah, right. Some of them could be...
Not just losing the venture capital money investments, but they're going to suffer the test of a downturn in the economy on their credit losses.
Right.
And which may be fine, but probably not if they don't have the experience.
Yeah, yeah. I know that I've always been a big fan of Wealthfront. I have a Wealthfront account, full disclosure. But my account has performed pretty well in a very robust bull market. Right. I wonder what will happen.
Even a pig flies in a tornado kind of thing, right?
Right. I wonder what will happen if I actually see a downturn, sort of a continued downturn in the market, whether we'll see a shift away from these new players or towards the more traditional like Fidelity and Schwab and other things of that sort.
Yeah, well, at least we know that Fidelity and Schwab will still be around. Yeah, I like this report. It's very like kind of techie friendly kind of thing. I almost feel like it's trying to scare the incumbent banks. And this is a consulting company, so this is they release these reports to obviously get business. But some funny things they mentioned is breaking up the market a certain way. They mentioned four digital ready banking business models. And so some of the names are kind of funny here. A utility provider, you can be a digital category killer or a digital relationship manager. Basically put digital in front of existing segments of the market.
And now you're tech forward and...
Yeah, open absolutely. Platform player. This sounds very much like the tech world. Like there's operating system provider and tools, Microsoft, that's like the open platform one. There's the digital relationship managers like a Facebook or a Twitter kind of thing. So I wonder if they're just transplanting a bit. And some of the suggestions are basically to do that, to copy the tech world, go where the customers are evolving towards.
Which I think we've seen in the U.S. I know that a lot of the larger banks here are looking into sort of embracing sort of the open banking architecture and having more APIs and making their services available wherever the customer is. So we may see the new players kind of driving that change in the incumbent banks, at least in the U.S.
Yeah, I saw in Canada, that was funny that they had the least penetration by new entrants into the market. So if you're an incumbent bank in Canada, you haven't been affected. You've, according to this report, it's been very minimal.
Go RBC.
this is like the nightmare for any of the competitors against tech when they come into your market, right? They're going to make you into a commodity, into the pipeline, and they're going to brand gonna
be the dumb pipes.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. And they're going to take all the value out of it.
Although, you know, despite what the report says, I've actually seen other data that suggests that the change from an incumbent bank, say Lloyds, to like a Revolut or something in the UK, is less than you think. So they're capturing market share, but I think that not everyone's switching their accounts from their big old bank with a branch down the street to this new app-based digital neobank project.
Yeah, right, right. They can keep that large bank, but then get all their other services through PSD2, through other connections in one app.
Right.
And so maybe they don't. Maybe the checking and savings is the lost leader, and they make the money on, you know, investments and brokerage and other services. But those are all getting whisked away by fintechs, and they can just see them in one place.
Right, right.
They don't have that captured market anymore.
Correct. Yeah. I'm not one to prognosticate on the whims of the
Congress. What's going to happen, Steve?
What's going to happen?
Tell me the future.
I can tell you what's not going to happen. I think that it's unlikely that we'll see something like PSD2 in the U.S., at least in the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a pretty safe bet right there. I'm really taking a chance here.
I won't bet against you on that one.
Yeah.
All right. Now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it.
So here's my final bite. John, what number or percentage, rather, of Argentinians do you think do not have a bank account?
So let me think. Argentina, well, they've had a lot of macroeconomic instability. It's probably scared some people away from banks, but still, they're relatively developed. I'm going to go with 22% of people don't have a bank account.
Wrong.
Oh, 23%.
A little higher than that. The number is actually 50%.
50? I wouldn't have thought that don't have a bank account.
They do not have a bank account. Yeah, so there's a great article in Forbes that highlights how Argentina could be the perfect market for fintech disruption. So they have a lot of volatility in the peso, all these bailouts, all this corruption kind of roiling the economy. And again, half of our Argentinians do not have a bank account. So this is a market that we've seen has had tremendous uptake of things like cryptocurrencies and things of that sort.
They're very tech-friendly?
They're very tech-friendly, and it's a kind of market that can really allow users to bypass the system because the system is so crappy. This article basically points out that this economy could really be ripe for neobanks to come in and for other players to come in as long as they can bypass the traditional banking system.
Yeah, it sounds like that's the kind of the case for, well, the blockchain currencies, but, you know, other fintech services that aren't tied to the volatility. I mean, you need a lot more than just a simple transaction currency to keep your business going, to do so many things that in day-to-day life, right?
Correct, yeah. Basically, this is an economy that's fairly dysfunctional, top-down. So this is a place where new players could really come in and make a difference.
Yeah, hopefully for a lot better.
Yeah, so just one data point here in the article is that inflation in Argentina rose 30% in 1 month, and the peso fell 20% against the dollar.
Whoa, okay, so maybe the Bitcoin would take care of a lot of the problems by itself.
It seems like it's a pretty seamless way to move money around.
Well, not Bitcoin, but just some kind of stability, yeah?
Some kind of way to bypass the system and make it easier for people in the country to either move money around or just do basic financial tasks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, not Bitcoin specifically, maybe, because that's pretty volatile. And if you want to run away from that, maybe one of those Tether cryptocurrencies. I don't know about Tether, the main one, but one of the new cryptocurrencies tied to a stable currency like the dollar or euro would be, I would think that'd be pretty appealing to me. To save my money in something like that.
I agree. So if you have a cryptocurrency that's pegged to a stable currency, off to Buenos Aires you go.
All right. Well, thanks. That's a very interesting final bite. Well, mine is a much larger final bite than yours this time. Mine is $571 million. So $571 million is the amount that's been stolen in cryptocurrencies by a hacking group known as Lazarus.
Is this a North Korean
group? This is. It's a North Korean hacking group tracked very closely by the South Korean government. and they've just made off with huge amounts from mainly South Koreans, unfortunately. And their main method of attack is phishing attacks. So people clicking just on the wrong thing. And so be careful when you're clicking on emails from people you don't know, or even check the email address, because they could get your contacts and make it look like it's someone you know. But this has been to the very deep regret of many people. So just a huge, and just points out again, we've mentioned before, the huge risk around not the blockchain itself, but all the pieces around it on both ends.
So just a quick note here, this is seems like an indication that the North Koreans are now moving away from, or maybe in addition to doing counterfeiting, they're now doing also.
Oh, I as well. Wouldn't, I think every type of criminal activity is probably...
They're doing it all.
Expanding, yeah.
Multitasking.
No, yeah, whether it's nuclear weapons or counterfeit currency or kidnapping, there just doesn't seem to be a limit with North Korea.
By the way, slightly off topic, but I recently read a book called Orphan Master's Son. Incredible book about North Korea and the regime. It takes place, I think, it's contemporaneous, but it's really interesting and a great look inside the regime and how they do business, including the kidnapping and the counterfeiting stuff.
Yeah, yeah. The Orphan Master's Son.
Orphan Master's Son. We'll put that in the show notes. Yeah. I think it won the Pulitzer, so it's not a little-known book. It's a well-known book.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, we'll check that out. So this is the amount that's been stolen since January of 2017, and that's just from one group. The report that this comes from, is actually points out that a very interesting fact: 10% of ICOs since early 2017 have been stolen. So these new initial coin offerings get out there; they don't have enough nodes on their blockchain to make it really secure. So let's say you have 50 nodes on your blockchain. You know, if you're a criminal group, a hacking group, you can create 51 nodes or fake accounts and rewrite the rules, create a new consensus, change all the tokens into your name and make off with them and get rid of them as soon as possible, because that thing's going to be worthless pretty soon anyway.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's just amazing how creative hackers and other criminals are when it comes to when there's money on the other side.
Right.
So yeah, tricks like fake websites. So it's a new ICO. So you don't know what the website's supposed to look like necessarily, mm-hmm. right? So there's just so many tricks like that. It's you have to almost begrudgingly respect all the tricks that they do, and many many others we won't get into here. Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions or comments, or want to suggest a topic, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. And thanks for listening.
Bye for now.